It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, despite federal labor protections, many workers on public construction projects report being shortchanged on their wages. We'll find out more. First, an analysis of the incentive deal to encourage electronics manufacturer Foxconn to build a plant in Wisconsin shows it could put a $1 billion strain on the state budget over the next decade. The incentive deal calls for Wisconsin to give $2.85 billion in state tax credits to the company over the next 15 years. Mark Sommerhauser is a political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he joins us now. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, where does the projected $1 billion strain possibly on the state budget over a decade, where does that figure come from?
Well, Veronica, that comes from an analysis that was released by the legislature's nonpartisan fiscal bureau here earlier this month. And it's based on an analysis that the bureau did in which they took into account the payments that the state would be making to Foxconn under the agreement that was negotiated with the company by Governor Scott Walker's administration. So kind of taking into account those payments that the state would be making to the company through refundable tax credits and trying to compare that to the amount of additional tax revenue that the state would potentially receive if this Foxconn campus were to be built here in Wisconsin, and just sort of comparing the two and seeing what the net impact would be to the state budget. Actually going out over the next three decades, the analysis looked at. And, of course, as you referenced, the impact being most acute here in the first decade.
And can you tell us where that impact might be felt in the state budget?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult thing to project because it's something that would, be up to lawmakers to decide. I mean, the impact would be to the state's general fund, which is the fund that really pays for most functions that we think of state government paying for, everything from K-12 schools to colleges and universities, property tax relief for payments to local governments, as well as health care programs. So, you know, the impact would be to the state's general fund. That's where we would be seeing the impact of these refundable tax credits. And it really would be up to lawmakers and the governor to figure out how that would sort of factor into the overall state budget and the level of funding for all those programs.
What did you hear from some spokespeople from agencies that could be facing a cut if they ended up competing for dollars with Foxconn or with each other because of Foxconn?
Sure. Well, we mostly spoke to sort of independent groups that are independent of the agencies, but in many cases will advocate for spending for, universities, healthcare programs, those sorts of things, schools. And, you know, I think the thing that we heard that was kind of the overriding theme was that, you know, this is something that will make competition a little bit more difficult and a little stiffer for us. In terms of being able to compete for the general fund spending that we compete for every 2 years when lawmakers put together a budget.
And after the credits are projected to end, which is about 2033, it sounds like that the investment wouldn't create a positive return till pretty far down the road. Can you walk us through that projection?
Yes, that's right. And that was, you know, some of your listeners may recall that was reported on to some extent right when the analysis came out earlier this month. It's about a 25-year timeline that Fiscal Bureau is projecting that it would take for the state to see a return on its investment starting in the year 2043. As you mentioned, the tax credits would be set to end in 2033, and that's really when the state, after that point, would start to start to really make money on the deal year after year under the projection, and then 10 years after that would finally start to see a positive return. For this piece that we wrote for our Sunday edition, we wanted to kind of focus on something that maybe hadn't gotten as much attention as the initial reports on the projection, which really did focus on that 25-year, understandably focused on that 25-year timeline to get a return. But we wanted to kind of focus on some of the short-term implications of this deal, what it would mean for the state over the next decade or so.
And what do we know about how tax revenue from Foxconn could impact all of this?
Sure. I mean, I think that's one of the things that probably is the most difficult for the Fiscal Bureau in terms of making these sorts of projections. And Fiscal Bureau, if you read their analysis, really repeatedly acknowledges the inherent difficulty of projecting not only how a huge deal like this will affect the state budget over a 30-year period, but even within that, the difficulty of projecting how much additional tax revenue the state would receive from a project like this. The Fiscal Bureau projection draws on some other analyses and studies that were commissioned both by Foxconn and by the state that take a look at both. So the additional income tax revenues that would be coming to the state from Foxconn employees that they would hire at the campus, the additional income taxes that would be paid by employees that would be hired at companies that would be suppliers for Foxconn, as well as it tries to take into account some of the revenues, mostly sales tax revenues, that would come from everything from, you know, all sorts of things that Foxconn employees and their suppliers' employees would buy, you know, anything from food to housing to any sorts of goods that they might buy that would create sales tax revenue for the state.
So as you said, this is all projected on variables that could change. And one of those variables when we talk about tax revenue could be, what if a bigger portion of the employees at Foxconn are from Illinois and they pay taxes to the state of Illinois? What are some of those other what ifs?
Yes. I think you hit on the biggest one, Veronica. I mean, this is the one, and this is also the one that lawmakers continue to raise as a question mark. You know, in the Fiscal Bureau analysis, it's actually based on all the employees being Wisconsin residents, but the Fiscal Bureau analysis, the table that I'm referencing that provides all these numbers, but then within the analysis, Fiscal Bureau says, we acknowledge that there's certainly a possibility that some of these employees could be from Illinois, and they are saying that, that they're throwing out a number that's based on kind of the typical percentage of employees in Racine and Kenosha counties, which are the two counties where Foxconn is expected to locate this campus. You know, roughly 10% of the people that work at businesses in those counties are Illinois residents. So they're saying if we made an assumption just for the purposes of discussion here that 10% of these employees would be Illinois residents, then it would push out the break-even date by just a few more years further in terms of the amount of time that the state would take to make back its investment. Simply because that those 10% of those employees would not, you know, be paying all their taxes to the state of Wisconsin. They would be paying taxes to Illinois, where they reside.
We're talking to Mark Sommerhauser right now from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at how the Foxconn incentives deal could impact Wisconsin state budget over the next decade. And one other aspect of this, as we start to wrap up, is the economy itself. And according to some economists, we could be due for a recession. How could that affect things?
I think that's the huge variable in this whole thing, and I mean it's a huge variable whenever you talk about the state budget. Certainly, independent of Foxconn, I mean the recession issue is always the thing that can have the greatest impact on tax revenues, that can create a budget crisis or a budget crunch that really requires lawmakers and the governor to make very difficult decisions. The thing that kept coming up when I spoke to folks about Foxconn is that, you know, there seems to be a consensus that if the state continues to experience the sort of revenue growth that it's seen over the past few years, that these Foxconn tax credits are probably going to be manageable. They're probably something that can be that can be absorbed into the budget without a lot of cuts or other things to other programs. However, the thing that did keep coming up is that if the state experiences a recession sometime here within the next decade, then that could be a different story. And you know, nationally, we're in a point where it's been close to a decade now since we've had a major economic downturn, and economists are saying that that is something that just simply looking at historical trends that we're likely due to see here within the next few years. So that's you know, that's certainly something that I think is a point of concern for the folks that spoke to us.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Mark Sommerhauser is a political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joined us to talk about how the Foxconn incentives deal could impact Wisconsin state budget down the road. Right now, President Trump has pledged to put America's tradespeople to work on new federal construction projects. The administration's proposed $1 trillion of infrastructure spending could do just that. But with more construction comes the job of making sure workers are paid what they're owed. A new report from the Center for Public Integrity finds that despite federal protections, some building contractors find a variety of ways to shortchange their workers. Getting those wages back can sometimes take years. Mariam Jamil is a reporter on the labor and environment team at the Center for Public Integrity. Mariam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the scope of the problem? How common does wage theft in construction work seem to be?
You know, that's a pretty hard thing to say precisely because we have the numbers that the Department of Labor finds as far as what they actually went out investigating and where they found violations, but they're only able to go to so many work sites and people are only coming forward so much. It seems you're getting a small representation of what might actually be happening. When the Department of Labor has more investigators, you see more cases coming to light. And sometimes when workers are given more information about their rights, you see more cases coming to light. So there are a lot of factors that kind of change what the public actually gets to learn about that I don't think necessarily reflect what's actually happening, if that makes sense.
Let's talk a little bit about the term itself, wage theft, as it applies to construction work. What is wage theft?
So wage theft is a term that's used basically for when a worker of any sort is given less money than they are legally owed. So in construction work, when it comes to government construction work, there's something called the Davis-Bacon Act that says that if this is a project that the government is funding or assisting in some way with the funding of, if it's over $2,000, which a lot of these projects are, they go into the millions, then workers are guaranteed a specific wage. So the Department of Labor kind of figures out a prevailing wage. So basically, there shouldn't be a ton of guesswork in terms of what an employer is owing their worker. So wage theft can mean that they are, say somebody is a plumber, and so under the Davis-Bacon Act, that means that they're owed, you know, $18.50 an hour. But their employer, for some reason or another, decides that they're going to mark them as general labor. And so they pay them, let's say, $13 an hour. Or, you know, they might not pay them proper overtime. Or sometimes a worker doesn't know all these different categorizations under the Davis-Bacon Act. There's, like, a lot that goes into what exactly someone should be owed. And there are ways that an employer can pay less without having that be obvious to the government or to the worker. And sometimes employers themselves can even be ignorant about, you know, what exactly they're supposed to be paying. The Davis-Bacon Act also says that you owe a worker fringe benefits. So that can mean, you know, that can mean retirement savings, that can mean health benefits. And I've definitely heard various workers and people who work on labor enforcement saying that their employer will just tell them, like, oh yeah, you have a retirement account and we're putting part of your wage into that. But that ultimately isn't true, and those things get kind of complicated to get a good understanding of sometimes, even as far as your own wage and what you're owed and to keep track of. So,
well, let's talk about a specific example. This is an active case, as I understand it, of the U.S. General Services Administration building.
Yeah, so in 2011, the General Services Administration renovated its headquarters, and one aspect of that was asbestos removal, which is, like, workers need to have training to know how to handle asbestos, which is something that is very dangerous. It can cause cancer. And so they hired, over the course of about a year, more than 100 workers to do this. They had a contractor who hired another contractor who then hired a staffing company to get all these people in. So it was a really murky employer relationship. Anyway, a lot of these workers, they didn't know what their classification under the Davis-Bacon Act was. So they were supposed to be skilled laborers. This employer said on paper that they were general laborers. They underpaid them by about $10 an hour, which adds up quite quickly. And there were all these workers who they didn't quite know what they were owed. They didn't know if they could speak up. It was a mess. There was also there were also discrimination complaints involved. It was like a really messy job. But all of these companies that were employed and involved in this were ultimately employed by the government, receiving government funds. So basically, these workers eventually complained with the help of a union. They pulled their case together, and 127 workers submitted a complaint to the Department of Labor in 2011. And sometimes these cases take a while to actually process, and then, you know, maybe the employer will have a different opinion than the workers do. So in conclusion, unfortunately, that case is still open to this day. So these workers whom the Department of Labor has decided are owed over $600,000 are still waiting for their money. The employers have contested the case, and so they say the workers aren't owed quite that much, or some of them say they're not owed at all. So 6 years later, a case with the Department of Labor is still open.
We're talking with Mariam Jamil right now from the Center for Public Integrity with us to talk about the problem of wage theft in construction and the difficulty of enforcing labor laws. And let's get into the enforcement aspect of it. As I understand it, this is the Labor Department and the Wage and Hour Division. Do they have the capacity to stay on top of this?
You know, I would say they do and they don't. They're consistently understaffed. They consistently ask for more. Under the Obama administration, they would consistently ask for more funding to get more investigators to just period be able to process more cases, go out into the field and find more cases, because they do a combination of things. They take complaints, but they also go about their own investigations that they initiate. So having spoken with people at the Department of Labor and former employees, a thing that I often hear is that they're understaffed. At the same time, they're never going to be able to police all the businesses in the country. And so another important thing that they do is try to educate employers on what the law is and educate workers on what their rights are.
Now, at the end of the Obama administration, the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces rule was put into place. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That rule, it's no longer in effect. President Trump dismantled it, but what was it looking to do?
So Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces was focused on making sure that if the government was going to contract with companies, that those companies weren't already also with labor disputes open against them, or with a really, you know, bad labor record. And when I say bad labor record, I mean maybe they've had multiple instances of wage theft, maybe there have been occupational safety violations against them, there are labor relations cases open against them, equal employment cases, things like that. So this law basically said that each agency is going to have staff in place who are well-versed in labor laws, who can help the contracting officers at those agencies see, like, okay, this is what this company has on its record. There are some things that need improvement or some things that are outstanding. How do we go about helping them be in compliance and still hopefully not debarring them or forbidding them from contracts, but reaching, like, a place where you're actually solving the problem and not just looking the other way? And from what I understand, the goal was to create a higher standard for labor and kind of set the example as the government, as an employer, for the companies it chose to employ. So that law is no longer. It was disbanded in March. It barely went into effect. Basically, one little aspect of it went into effect for a few months, but there was also a lawsuit against it by a couple of trade groups. One of them was a construction industry group, actually, that said aspects of it were unconstitutional. So it was very controversial, and it may not even have survived if the current Congress and President Trump had chosen to undo it. So yeah, there were measures taken in the past few years to try to curb this problem, and they are no longer in place.
And Mariam, as we wrap up, just briefly, what is the outlook like for stopping or addressing the problem of wage theft left under the Trump administration today?
Well, the Trump administration has its proposed budget out, and its budget for the Department of Labor does not look to cut staff in particular in terms of wage and hour enforcement. It's basically proposing to keep the levels of funding and staff that were given to the latest to this current fiscal year that the Obama administration asked for. So they have not been particularly loud about saying, hey, we really want to increase our enforcement budget. This is a huge problem. We want to crack down on employers. That was more the line of the previous administration. But they're also not saying we want to gut enforcement staff. They're basically currently just asking for a little bit more funding to focus on compliance assistance, which they definitely have voiced wanting to be more sort of friendly to employers. They're, I think, more open to employers that are trying to say, like, hey, don't just hit us with fines, work with us rather than cracking down on us. We might see enforcement get a little lighter. I think they're definitely they're going about having a different attitude towards enforcement. They're more business friendly, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll see weaker enforcement since they're trying to maintain the same budget as before.
Mariam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mariam Jamil, labor and environment reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. She was with us to talk about the problem of wage theft in construction and the difficulty of enforcing labor laws. First, it's no secret that the proportion of Americans who marry has gone down in recent decades, but something that's newer is the demographic leading the shift away from marriage. Just decades ago, Americans without college degrees were much more likely to be married, but that's no longer the case. Victor Tan Shen is with us now. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, and he's the author of two books, including Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. And his latest piece is called America, Home of the Transactional Marriage. He joins us now from WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Victor, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Veronica.
Well, the U.S. is seeing a rise in what you call transactional marriage. Can you describe what you mean by that term?
Sure. So marriage rates, as you noted, have gone down. What we see now is the driving force that is making the change between college-educated households and working-class households, those with a high school degree or less, is the scarcity of good jobs out there, that working-class people find it hard to get the types of jobs that paid good wages, that had benefits, you know, these unionized factory jobs of the past. And so what is happening is there's a lot of strain, financial strain, on certain households in this country. And as a result, decisions to stay together, to start a family or so on, are really being pushed by these kinds of economic forces that families at the lower end of the educational spectrum have become much more fragile, much less likely to get together to start a family in a marital bond.
And we've been seeing this trend for a while of declining marriages. Can you tell us a little more about who is and who isn't getting marriage and how big that difference between the two groups is?
Sure. So in 1990, you had a situation where those with more education, with college degrees, were more likely to be unmarried. Those who just had a high school degree or less were more likely to be married. And now, since 2008, that has flipped around. And, you know, just give you one stat, among women in their early 40s, you know, half of those women who just have a high school degree are married, compared to three quarters of those women who are college grads, right? So there's this substantial difference that has opened up, and it's been driven by educational differences. And, you know, it plays into this larger picture, Veronica, where, you know, obviously the culture has changed, right? People are more accepting of not marrying, of having kids outside of marriage. But what has happened in the last few decades is this class divide opening up. And a big part of that story is decline of good jobs for those with less education. Because, you know, families to stay together, that's a big part of the equation, right? How much can you contribute, especially at a time when you need two earners in a household, right, to kind of stay afloat. And, you know, the lack of a good earner or having a spouse who is unemployed, that's not as tenable as it was when you could get by with just one earner.
Or I suppose if you're one of these men you're talking about in a position of having less education, looking for one of those jobs that used to be there, like manufacturing, that would be a decent wage maybe for your life. If you're there now, don't have a job, it's probably hard to reach out to someone to date and get married and find a partner who's willing to maybe overlook that unemployment.
Yeah, I think to some extent it's always been the case that you know, men in particular have to have that steady living in order to attract a mate, to get married and so on. But in some ways, it has gotten harder because our economy has shifted in certain ways. You know, I mentioned the kind of blue-collar factory jobs that have been disappearing over the last several decades. You know, those paid well. They had good benefits. They were often unionized. The kinds of jobs that have replaced them, you know, tend to pay very little. They have erratic schedules, and people have to cobble together enough hours to support themselves. It's a very different landscape for those with less education. And, you know, Veronica, this is not an insignificant segment of the population. You know, two-thirds of Americans 25 and older do not have a bachelor's degree. So we have to keep that in mind, that a large segment of the population are struggling, and they're struggling economically, and that bleeds over into their family relationships as well.
And we should talk about how, as you look at this phenomenon of the transactional marriage, you looked a lot at men and focused on them as a part, a big part of what was driving the shift. Why look at men more than at women's wages and women's jobs, for instance?
Yeah. I think in this day and age, you know, we, you know, to our credit, think in more equitable terms about marriages and who should be contributing to the marriage. That said, if you look at the data, if you look, and here I'm thinking about a study by David Otter at MIT and some collaborators, where they looked at the impact of job loss in various communities across the country and what impact that job loss, which was from Chinese imports, what effect that had on marriage rates and childbirth within marriage rates. And they found that when industries were hit hard that tended to have lots of male workers, well, marriage declined and childbirth within marriage declined. But when industries that had large numbers of women were hit hard, the opposite happened for some reason, that you know, marriage rates actually increased. And so there's this component of these traditional norms that are still lingering within our society, where men are expected to still be, you know, breadwinners. Still, their masculinity is linked to their ability to provide. And we can think of that as unfair, but that is how a lot of Americans think of this. That said, you know, right now, women are four out of every 10 primary breadwinners in this country, right? They've definitely stepped up in terms of providing financially. And when you ask men what they're looking for in a marriage partner, you know, almost half of them say that they want a spouse, a woman with a steady job. So it is changing, perhaps, these norms. But still, if you look at the patterns out there, it's very influenced by gender roles.
And you take this all a step further and look at the policy aspect of this and how a public safety net could affect marriage rates within sort of this phenomenon that you're describing. And I wonder if you could tell us a story. You tell this in your piece of a Canadian man who's unemployed, and he decides that he's going to commit suicide. He goes and he's going to step in front of a truck. Would you tell us what happens next?
Sure. So this man who used to work in a auto plant in Ontario, right across the river from Detroit, he grew depressed after he lost his job. It was part of his identity, you know, that was a central, you know, part of who he was and had been for such a long time. And it really hurt him not being able to help his wife and his teenage daughter out. He felt useless, he told me. And so he almost committed suicide. He didn't go through with it. He didn't jump in front of a truck as he had planned to do. And he went home and he, you know, talked things out with his wife. He tried to get therapy, and eventually, you know, things worked out for him in part because of some assistance from a government-funded training center staffed by some of his former coworkers. It was partly because he had tuition paid for him to go back to school and have his unemployment benefits extended. These kinds of support gave him a sense of meaning that it that he had identity as a student, for one thing, that it wasn't all down to him in order to pull in that paycheck and feel useful again. So, I mean, that's not the entire picture. Obviously, in every single relationship, there's a mixture of emotional, psychological, and financial considerations. But when we look at the broader trends, when we sociologists understand what's going on with marriage, that plays a role, right? How much support you have in terms of providing for your family and picking up the pieces after a job loss, that matters. That could really play into the equation of whether people stay together after a job loss.
We're exploring right now how jobs and labor markets have shaped American relationships. Our guest is Victor Tan Chen, assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. And we want to hear from you. Has the loss of a job or the decline of available jobs affected your relationship? Is unemployment stopping you from thinking about marriage, or maybe it's causing a strain in your current marriage? You can give us a call and share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation now about how the loss of good jobs, good blue-collar jobs, has affected relationships. Victor Tan Chen is with us. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. And he's the author of the piece, America, Home of the Transactional Marriage, in The Atlantic magazine. And we'd love to hear from you. Has unemployment ended or maybe strained your relationship? Have you decided not to be with someone because of your employment status or maybe because of your partner's? You can let us know by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Aaron with us in Madison. Aaron, hi.
Hi, Veronica.
Hi, what did you want to share?
Hi, I'm a divorcee. I'm 32. I have a great job, and so does my boyfriend, but we've chosen not to get married just because of the strain of finances and, you know, just being in and out of jobs. We just chose to not be, like, am I trying to say? Like in competition, I guess is what you can say.
Maybe.
So we have a happy relationship, and we've just chosen not to get married, but we're very happy just being two breadwinners on our own.
Erin, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate you sharing your story today. And Victor, when you hear that story, it sounds as though Erin and her significant other are happy not being married. I think she's kind of implying that the way the economy is, one of them might have a job offer and want to move, and the other might need to follow a different direction for his or her job, and so this makes things a little easier. Is this maybe reflective of the way that our economy ebbs and flows and the way people move around to follow the jobs?
Sure. I think Erin raises a really good point about, there's other options out there. And as you were saying, it's partly economic, partly about flexibility, partly cultural, too, that we accept that people won't get married. And that's totally fine. I guess the one of the issues here is that, and I think Erin's comment alludes to this, is that in America still, marriage is seen as an ideal. It's kind of like the culmination of your life's work, in the sense of being an individualist, being someone who's out for success and trying to advance oneself and so on. So we don't require marriage, we don't require it even, for having a child. It's less stigmatized to do that. But at the same time, it's an ideal. You could see that in Hollywood, how this soulmate kind of ideal that one has to find that perfect person. And that is something that a lot of Americans no longer can achieve because they can't find that perfect person because so many people do not have opportunities in this economy, and therefore they're not really good investments for that long-term commitment. So we have this kind of conflict in this country, Veronica, where we have this culture, this ideal of marriage, and yet we have this economy that is so divided and so disadvantaged. So some segments are so disadvantaged within this economy that it's hard for them to start a family.
And we were talking a little bit about how public policy affects what we're seeing in terms of marriage rates, and I wonder how important you found a social safety net is when it comes to supporting a marriage when times do get tough. And you looked at Canada and the United States. What have you seen there?
Yeah, I should note that Canada and the United States are not dramatically different in the ways that parts of Europe are to the United States. But they do have a stronger safety net. They have policies in place, more extensive unemployment benefits, but also, benefits for parents who have kids, regardless of their marital status. It's more generous. In fact, it very recently, last year, those child benefits were expanded there. And so that kind of support, it changes, it nudges people in a certain direction in terms of their, even in terms of the romantic relationships, right? You have more security knowing that there's some help out there. And it plays into our decisions as Americans. If you are a working class person and don't have such great job prospects, well, you definitely need to find a partner who can pull his or her weight, right? It's so essential to have that kind of partnership in place. And so you probably wouldn't want to take the risk with someone who doesn't fit those standards. And so I think that is, part of this calculation, which is different in other countries, not just culturally, but also in terms of what is the amount of how great is the risk for you as an individual in the labor market, but also in the marriage market.
Right, and I think there's in your piece, you talked about how there's some evidence that when the social safety net is really robust, that may also encourage people not to get married because they have so much freedom and financial security that maybe they have the opportunity not to get married.
Yeah. It's always a question, Veronica, of, to what extent are these differences due to different cultures and to what extent are they due to policy or to the state of the economy or so on? In Europe, cohabitation, where you have a live-in partner who is not married to you, that's much more common in many parts of Europe. And in fact, it takes a form that's pretty similar to marriage here in the United States. You know, it tends to be longer term, tends to be more stable than is the case here with our live-in arrangements, right? So, you know, part that that might be a cultural difference. You know, but we're looking at the U.S. situation and looking at the role of policy. There's also this debate, you know, over whether the social safety net, the size of it, discourages or encourages marriage. And, you know, that debate is very contentious politically. I should say, though, that, you know, the size of benefits in the United States declined over a period of time. This is welfare benefits and other benefits. Decline adjusted for inflation over a period of time in the last century, in the latter part of the last century, and when that was a period of time when we saw those rates of childbirth outside of marriage and marriage increasing and marriage rates plummeting. So I have my doubts about this argument that a safety net would necessarily discourage marriage. So in fact, I find that in my own research that having that kind of support helps keep families from falling apart because they have more of a sense of security and it's not so fraught with this anxiety over how to make ends meet.
Got a comment here on Facebook from Catherine who says, honestly, the only reason I got married was strictly financial. My husband and I used to joke about it being a green card-like marriage. We had to get married to be able to get insurance together and save money because we didn't want to pay for separate insurance costs. So there's a practical look at marriage. You said that's the driving factor there. Is that something that you're seeing, that it, the transactional marriage in action there with Catherine?
Yeah, I don't want to give the impression that, you know, everyone, when we're deciding marriage to get married, are just thinking about pocketbook issues or, you know, are just focused on dollar bills. You know, obviously there's so much at work here and hopefully it primarily it's probably emotional connection and things like that. But, you know, those things do factor in and it nudges people in certain directions in terms of their personal decisions. So things like, you know, health insurance, the fact that we don't have universal health insurance and it's so tied to who your employer is, you know, you could see that changing or at least factoring into people's decisions about whether to get married or not. So I think that we need to take that seriously. And if in terms of explaining why working class people are marrying less, I think the economy has a lot to do with that.
Is there an indication as we wrap up, Victor, that some of the people you write about, working class people, blue collar people who might have gotten those older manufacturing jobs, they would like to get married, but that is the primary obstacle is money?
Yeah, I think, and especially for the men, to be honest, and, you know, we were talking about gender roles before, but for a lot of them, you know, it's a sense of their own manhood has been lost when they lose their job, when they lose a good job that was a dignified job that, you know, paid the bills and allowed for some stability in their lives and potentially in their partner's life. So, you know, we have this stigma about, you know, the so-called deadbeat dad or the scrub who can't, you know, provide and so on. And I think that has a disproportionate impact on those who are not doing so well in this economy.
Victor, thank you so much for joining us. We have to leave it there. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Victor Tanshen is assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, joined us to talk about how employment and unemployment have changed the idea of marriage. We're all following the unfolding of events after Hurricane Harvey here on Central Time, the stories of kindness, the incredible courage and the help that friends and neighbors and strangers are showing each other. And tomorrow morning, Joy Cardine will talk to a guest after 7:30 about how to donate to help out after Hurricane Harvey. Right now, we wanted to take a little bit of time during the show to say we're thinking of you, Texas, and we're sending lots of love and lots of hope from Wisconsin.